To begin this lecture in ancient Israel, we're going to be focusing on the archaeological revolution that took place in the 1930s and 40s, especially under the leadership of men like William Foxwell Albright, who's considered probably the dean of Palestinian archaeologists. That it is this material evidence that they uncovered during this series of activities in Canaan, both east and west, that caused the scholars to begin to question seriously the chronological information provided in 1 Kings 6:1 and begin to question the traditional date of the Exodus that would have been in the 15th century or the 18th dynasty of Egypt. We also have to learn to deal with archaeological periods. And so I have this chart which gives the general ranges for the major archaeological periods. I will be giving you some more precise distinctions as we go along, but at least this will give you the major breakdowns, because it's impossible to do any reading at all, and even archaeological material written for the layperson, if you don't have some familiarity with these terms. For your information, I've also provided on the handout some of the terms that are provided by Israeli archaeologists for these periods, though they are rarely used by even the Israeli archaeologists when writing to the larger world community, simply because they're too narrow and restrictive. There's almost a universal agreement that they should use the terms that are on the left side of the chart. So the ones on the right are just provided for your information. For instance, if you were to visit the Israel Museum in Jerusalem and visit the archaeological wing, the rooms would be labeled according to the terminology you see on the right. But otherwise, that's the only time I know when it is commonly used. Some of the Israeli writers will use it, but usually they won't, or their editors overseas will correct them so that other people know what they're talking about. As you can see, that regardless of whether we date the conquest to be early or late, regardless of whether we put the Exodus in the 15th century B.C., or in the 13th century B.C., the events would take place in what is called the Late Bronze Age. The Late Bronze Age. Now, there is a difference, of course, as we break the period of the Late Bronze into finer divisions. As you can see, they're labeled Late Bronze 1, Late Bronze 2A, Late Bronze 2B, where you would expect to find evidence of the Israelite conquest of Canaan. If we assume the traditional date to be correct, that the Israelites came out of Egypt in about the middle of the 15th century B.C., then they would, of course, have been invading Canaan around 1400 B.C., around 1400 B.C., which corresponds to the end of the Late Bronze I period. So the end of Late Bronze I is 1400 B.C. This is a piece of information you should become very familiar with. Now, what happened when the archaeologists went out into the field in Canaan and sought the evidence of the Israelite conquest by studying the layers of the different tells, looking for evidence of massive destruction at the end of the Late Bronze I period? What did they find? Well, I think what will be helpful is if we get our orientation, first of all, with what we did with the map in yesterday's historical geography class. So if we can have that machine on and focused on the screen. Okay, our general topic here today. Here is the map that we had yesterday. The Bible is very rich in detail in Numbers chapter 21, and especially that chapter, in providing us information about the activities of the Israelites east of the Jordan. Let's take a look in Numbers chapter 21 and read some of that specifically. Actually, it also relates to the map that we had earlier, even in the wilderness wanderings. In fact, I'm going to begin with that in the beginning of Numbers chapter 21. When the king of Arad, the Canaanite who dwelt in the south heard that Israel was coming on the road to Atharim, the way of the scorpions, the way of the spies, that he fought against Israel and took some of them prisoners. So Israel made a vow to the Eternal and said, if you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And the Eternal listened to the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them in their cities, so the name of the place was called Hormah. So the very first engagement between the Israelites and Canaanites in the area they were to later inhabit was when they made this attack on the southern area, the area of Arad, because the king of Arad had attacked them first. Then we find that after they had journeyed around Edom and Moab, they arrived in the valley of the Arnon, and they then began to enter the territory of King Zion the Amorite. Okay, verse 21 of Numbers 21. Israel sent messengers to Zion, king of the Amorites, saying, let me pass through your land. We will not turn aside to the fields or the vineyards. We will not drink water from the wells, but we will go by the king's highway until we have passed through your territory. But Zion would not allow Israel to pass through his territory. Zion gathered all his people together, went out against Israel in the wilderness. He came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. So once again, we have the initiative being taken by the enemy. Israel defeated him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Yabbok. Remember, these are both the names of rivers. The Arnon being the border, the northern border of Moab, located here on the map, and the Yabbok being located here, actually separating the two parts of Gilead. So all this area between the Arnon and the Yabbok was taken over by Israel for themselves because King Zion the Amorite had the temerity to attack them. As far as the people of Ammon, for the border of the people of Ammon was fortified, as a sort of parenthetical statement, Israel took all of these cities, and Israel dwelt in all the cities of the Amorites, in Heshbon and in all of its villages. For Heshbon was the city of Zion, king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and had taken all of his land from his hand as far as the Arnon. Now that's an important piece of information we'll be picking up on later, is that Zion had fought against Moab and taken this entire area away from Moab. It had previously belonged to Moab. But at the time Israel came on the scene, the Arnon was the northernmost border of Moab, and this had been occupied by this intruder, Zion, the king of the Amorites. And Israel then took it from him. They did not take it directly from the Moabites. They took it from Zion, the king of the Amorites. Verse 31, Israel dwelt in the land of the Amorites. Well, archaeologists went out into the field in this area, and they concluded as follows. Heshbon was unoccupied during the late Bronze Age. There was no city there. There was no city at Heshbon in the late Bronze Age. So what do we do with this biblical mention of them taking it, that it represents a problem? Okay, perhaps we will do better when we come to the matters across the Jordan. So let us consider the matters across the Jordan. Here is a map that is a summary of Joshua's activities. Oops. Okay, now we have it in focus. According to the book of Joshua, the Israelites crossed the Jordan River, they encamped at Gilgal, and then in succession they attacked and conquered Jericho. They made an alliance with Gibeon, foolishly, they were tricked into it, and then had to defend the city of Gibeon when Gibeon was attacked by the leaders of Jerusalem and Hebron, and Lachish, and I'm sorry, not Lachish, Yarmouth and Libna. These people gathered their forces together to attack Gibeon because they were angry that Gibeon had made an alliance with Israel. So Israel had to come and defend the Gibeonites. Then they chased the Canaanites down into this region, and the Bible says in Joshua chapter 10 that they conquered the city of Libna, the city of Lachish, the city of Eglon, either located here or there. There's a debate as to where it's located. The city of Hebron and the city of Debir. Then in a northern campaign, Joshua conquered the city of Hazor, that Joshua fought against a league of Canaanite kings at the waters of Meron, which is difficult to locate it, but it's somewhere in this vicinity in the Upper Galilee. And then following the Israelite victory over the Canaanites, they turned back, as it says in the text, and they took and burned the city of Hazor. This is what the text tells us in chapter 11 of the book of Joshua. So this is a summary of his campaign. These are the cities that are mentioned. Jericho, Ai being destroyed, Gibeon being successfully defended after being tricked into making peace, and then destroying Libna, Eglon, Lachish, Hebron, and Debir. Okay, what do we find when we look into the record? Well, let's begin with Jericho, since that was the first target. We have the very picturesque explanation of how God, through a miracle, caused the walls of the city to collapse, thereby laying the city open to the Israelites to take it. When we go to Jericho, and we get on the tell itself, as Kathleen Kenyon did, and conducted a massive excavation of this 10-acre site, you can see in this slide some of the trenches that she dug through the mound, one very prominent one here, one coming in from this side. These were dug by Kathleen Kenyon, the two major trenches, and then there were a number of other areas that she explored around the perimeter as well. She was not the first one to dig here, but it's considered that Kathleen Kenyon, or to use her full title, Dame Kathleen Kenyon, did the definitive dig at Jericho. What did she find? Well, she found that the city had been destroyed at the end of the Middle Bronze Age. Now, you can see on the chart when the end of the Middle Bronze Age was, 1550. There was a massive destruction of the city at that particular period of time. Then, what she found is that the city was empty from 1550 B.C. until around 1440 B.C. And then, working on the basis of evidence found in the tombs, this is a significant point we'll have reason to come back to later, that working on the basis of evidence found in the tombs, she concluded that the city was inhabited continuously, important word, from 1440 B.C. until 1325 B.C. It was continuously inhabited, she said, from 1440 B.C. until 1325 B.C., and then from 1325 B.C. until the middle of the 9th century B.C., until around 850 approximately, the city was empty. Now, let's write this on the board and take a closer look at it and see what this does. What does this conclusion give us? That we have the city was destroyed in 1550. These are all round numbers, I hope you understand. Then it was continuously, and I emphasize that word, inhabited from 1440 to 1325 B.C. In other words, it was empty. It was empty from 1550 until around 1440. Then it was continuously inhabited from 1440 to 1325, and then it was empty from 1325 B.C. to approximately 850 B.C. Actually, it would be a little earlier when it would have been re-inhabited, since it was re-inhabited in the days of Ahab, according to the Bible, and that they found evidence from Ahab's period at Jericho. Now, what does that do with, in terms of the biblical record? Now remember, if we work on the basis of 1 Kings 6:1, which says there was 480 years from the fourth year of Solomon to the Exodus, that takes us back from 965 plus 480 equals 1445 approximately. We're using round numbers. And then that's the date of the Exodus, 1445. Minus 40 years for the wilderness wanderings then brings us down, I should say not minus, but plus 40 years for the wilderness wanderings brings us down to about 1405 approximately B.C. for the conquest. The period of the conquest is 40 years after the Exodus. What is the record of Jericho for 1405? What does it show? Continuously inhabited. There is no sign of any destruction in this period. So this is a major conflict with the biblical record. A major conflict, because a great deal is made about the conquest of Jericho. This is not some incidental, by the way, we conquered Jericho kind of thing. But, you know, there's a lot of attention focused on it. If you count the chapters dealing with the investigations of the spies who come into Jericho and Rahab hiding them, and the actual circling of the city and the fall of the city thereof, you've got a lot of attention in and when you take a look at the whole history of the conquest, Jericho gets more attention than anything else. And yet, according to Catherine Kenyon's conclusions, the city could not possibly have been destroyed between those dates. All right. Now, somebody had a question, comment or something. I saw a hand waving. Who was it?
It was just to do with the math.
Okay. Figured out. Did I make a mistake with the math?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. Sometimes I do. Math is not my strong point. So please don't hesitate if I make a mistake. Okay. So we have the problem then with Jericho. Now, what about the next campaign? Maybe then we'll do better if we get to Ai. Okay, let us consider the situation of Ai. Do I have another one? No, that's something else. I'll wait to come back to that later. Let's take Ai. All right, excavations were done at Ai in the 1930s by a French woman by the name of, her last name was Margaret Krauss, and it has since been dug by an American team in the 1960s as well, under Joseph Calloway, and the conclusion remains the same, is that when we examine the situation of Ai, it was destroyed towards the end of the early Bronze Age, approximately 2400 B.C. And then it was uninhabited until the Iron 1A period, shortly after what date? When does the Iron 1A begin, according to your chart? 1200. Shortly after 1200 B.C. is when it was next inhabited. And all that it was an unwalled village. So, how does this square with the record? Well, let's read the record. We find the account of the destruction of Ai beginning in verse 7. After the destruction of Jericho, we find the children of Israel committed a trespass regarding the accursed things, for Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed thing. Actually, accursed is probably the wrong word. Things placed under the ban that they were not to touch. So the anger of the Eternal burned against the children of Israel. Now, this is the account according to the Bible. Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is beside Beth-Aven, on the east side of Bethel, and spoke to them, saying, go up and spy out the country. So the men went up and spied out Ai. They returned to Joshua and said, don't let all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and attack Ai. Do not weary all the people there, for the people of Ai are few. So about 3,000 men went up from the people, but they fled before the men of Ai. The men of Ai struck down about 36 men, for they chased them from before the gate. Before the gate.
What chapter are you reading now?
Chapter 7 of Joshua. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you... Didn't I say 7? I said verse 7. I'm sorry. Chapter 7. No wonder all this noise of paper is going on here. Chapter 7 I'm reading in. I'm now in verse 3. I'm sorry, verse 5. The men of Ai struck down about 36 men, for they chased them from before the gate. What is that telling us about Ai? It has a wall. It's a walled city if it has a gate. As far as Sherebiam, and they struck them down on the descent, and therefore the hearts of the people melted and became like water. Now after they repented, of course, and found out what the problem was, and had taken care of the person who had committed the evil, then of course they could count on God's blessing. And so we proceed to chapter 8 of Joshua. The Eternal said to Joshua, do not be afraid nor be dismayed. Take all the people of war with you. Arise, go up to Ai. See, I have given it into your hand, the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. You shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king. Only this time, its spoil and cattle you shall take as booty for yourselves. Lay an ambush for the city behind it. So Joshua arose and all the people of war to go up against Ai. And Joshua chose 30,000 mighty men of valor and sent them away by night, telling them, behold, you shall lie in ambush against the city behind the city. Don't go far from the city, but be ready. Then I and all the people who are with me will approach the city. It will come about when they come out against us as at the first time that we shall flee before them. For they will come out after us until we have drawn them from the city. For they will say they are fleeing before us as at the first. Therefore we will flee before them. Then you shall rise from the ambush and seize the city, for the Eternal your God will deliver it into your hand. It will be when you have taken the city that you shall set the city on fire. According to the commandment of the Eternal you shall do. And that's exactly what happened. Joshua had the main group go up and pretend to attack the city. And then as the warriors began to respond from inside the city, the Israelites pretended to be afraid again and run away. The soldiers of Ai came rushing out. And then the group in ambush responding to a signal given by Joshua, who had stood on a prominent hill to the north where he could see both groups, gave the signal. They rushed into the city, which was defenseless. They burnt it. And then when the smoke of the city began to ascend, as it says in verse 20, when the men of Ai looked behind them, they saw and behold the smoke of the city ascended to heaven. So they had no power to flee this way or that. And then, of course, they were killed. And the city, of course, was then Israel's. But they have this very elaborated, rather extensive account of the conquest of Ai, including a very interesting feature, that first when they tried to take the city, the Israelites were defeated. And only after the second attempt were they successful, and yet the archaeological record says nothing was there. It was an empty, open hill. There was nothing to conquer. So this is the problem with Ai. I forgot to mention, I apologize for my poor organization this morning. Remember I began with Arad in the south, the king of Arad who attacked Israel when they were still in the wilderness, and they went up and then defeated him? Well, they investigated Arad, and at Arad there's nothing between a city destroyed in the early Bronze Age and a settlement begun there in the Iron Age around the year 1100. So again, an empty place at Arad, nothing there. No king of Arad to attack them. So we're having these two conspicuously empty places. The problem with Heshbon is empty. The problem with Arad, it's empty. The problem with Jericho, it wasn't destroyed at the right time. It was continuously inhabited, and Ai didn't exist. Now, what about Gibeon? Maybe now we'll get into something that at least begins to fit. Well, here's a map that shows us an account of the campaign where Joshua came up to assist the Gibeonites. They were being attacked by the king of Jerusalem and his allies. They came up from Gilgal, and they chased the Canaanites away down the Beth-horon Pass, crossed the head of the Valley of Ajalon as far as Azekah, and then, of course, they began to mop up some of these cities. Now, as you can see, the king of Yarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, the king of Hebron down here, just off the map, and Debir, as well as the king of Jerusalem, were allied against Gibeon. And Gibeon was successfully defended by the Israelites. We read about this in chapter 10 of Joshua. We won't take a whole lot of time to look at it. It's there. You can read it for yourself. What then? Well, the archaeologists have gone to work at Gibeon. And they found that in the late Bronze Age, they found no evidence for any city. They find a city there in the Middle Bronze Age, and then they find an Iron Age city, but nothing of the late Bronze Age. Now, what period of time does 1405 BC land in again? It's the late Bronze Age. It's the end of the late Bronze One. There was no city of Gibeon. What about the cities that were attacking Gibeon? What has been found out about those? Jerusalem did exist. Hey, got a score. Yarmuth, we're not sure if we have located it. You know, we look for these places in the areas where they're described as being, Yarmuth has been found. I'm thinking about Libna. Yarmuth has been found, but the evidence so far does not indicate any late bronze presence there. Libna was a city mentioned in Joshua chapter 10 as being destroyed by Israel. We're not sure because the excavation there is rather inconclusive, and it may not be the site of Libna anyway. There's some doubt as to whether they've really found the site of Libna, so we'll leave that aside. Lachish, hey, that was destroyed in the late Bronze Age. We've got a score there. We're not sure where Eglon is. And the record is not yet clear for Eglon, so we cannot make any comment about Eglon pro or con. Then we come to Hebron. Hebron did not exist in the 15th century, did not exist around 1405. There are no remains from the late Bronze One period in Hebron. It was an empty period. There are remains from the late Bronze II, but not the late Bronze I. The city of Debir, again, we have a problem. No remains from the late Bronze I. So out of all these cities, Jericho was inhabited instead of being destroyed. Ai did not exist. Gibeon did not exist. Lachish we get a score with, Jerusalem we get a score with, Hebron and Debir did not exist. The others are not yet capable of being read accurately. Now before we leave this particular area of the country, we should notice something else. And that is, what major city does the book of Joshua conspicuously omit claiming to have conquered? Bethel. And yet, in Joshua chapter 12, towards the end of the chapter, you have a listing of all the kings which were destroyed by the Israelites. What does it say there? Is Bethel mentioned at all? What does it say? Did you find it? Verse 9. It says, the king of Ai, which is beside Bethel, won, that they destroyed. And then in verse 16, it says, the king of Makkedah won, the king of Bethel won. The king of Bethel is claimed to have been killed, but the city is not mentioned as having been conquered. This is comparable to what we find later in the list down here. We find the king of Gezer. How did the king of Gezer get into the account in Joshua chapter 12? If we read in chapter 10, verse 33, it mentions that Horam, the king of Gezer, came up to help Lachish. And Joshua struck him and his people until he left him none remaining. So the king of Gezer very unwisely took an army from his own city to the city of Lachish in order to assist the king of Lachish in resisting the attack by the Israelites. Here is Gezer on the map. You can see he came along here to assist at Lachish, and he got clobbered for his efforts. Now, the Bible specifically says nothing about them conquering Gezer. And later on in the book of Judges, in chapter 1, it mentions Gezer specifically as one of those cities they could not conquer, you see. So this is something which appears in the account. That's why we have a mention of the king being killed, but not the city. The same thing is probably true with the king of Bethel. The king of Bethel got killed because he stuck his nose in where it didn't belong, just like the king of Gezer, but his city was not taken at the time. And yet, we're going to have a reason to come back to this business of Bethel very shortly, before the end of the hour. Let's take a look at the north. It mentions in chapter 11, it came to pass, when Jabin the king of Hazor heard these things, that he sent to Jobab the king of Madon, to the king of Shimron, the king of Aksaph, to the kings who were from the north in the mountains and the plains south of Kinneret, in the lowland, to the heights of Dor on the west, to the Canaanites in the east and to the west, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite in the mountains, the Hivite below Hermon in the land of Mizpah. So they went out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore in multitude, very many horses and chariots. And when all these kings had met together, they came and camped together at the waters of Merom, to fight against Israel. But the Eternal said to Joshua, do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. And so Joshua and all the people of war with him came against them suddenly by the waters of Merom. They attacked them, and the Eternal delivered them into the hand of Israel, who defeated them and chased them to Greater Sidon, to the brook Misrephoth, and to the valley of Mizpah eastward. They attacked them until they left none remaining. As Joshua did as the Eternal had told him, they hamstrung their horses and burnt their chariots with fire. Then in verse 10, Joshua turned back at that time and took Hazor, struck its king with a sword, for Hazor was formerly the head of all those kingdoms. And they struck all the people who were with it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was none left breathing. And then he burned Hazor with fire. Now, do we find a destruction in the 15th century of Hazor that coincides with the biblical account? Here again, we find a match. Here again, we find a match. Now, this is the end of the record as far as Joshua's campaigns. How many matches do we have? Well, let us construct a list. We have Arad and Hormah, the two cities that belong to the king of Arad that attacked them in the wilderness. Then we have the city of Heshbon and the entire area there, and the kingdom of Zion, king of the Amorites. Then we have Jericho. Then we have Ai, Then we have Gibeon, not so much because they conquered it, but because they made peace with it, and they had to defend it. Then we have Jerusalem. Then we have the others allied with Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Debir, the king of Lachish, the king of Yarmuth. And then we have the city of Libna that was destroyed by Joshua in that campaign. And we have the city of Eglon. And then in the north, we have Hazor. How many hits do we get? Well, we get a miss on Arad, we get a miss on Hormah, we get a miss on Heshbon, a miss on Jericho, because it's not destroyed at that time, a miss at Ai, a miss at Gibeon, a plus at Jerusalem, a miss at Hebron, a miss at Debir, a plus, we get a score on Lachish. Yarmuth, we don't know because the record is not clear. Libna, the record is not clear. Eglon, it's not clear. And we get a hit at Hazor. So out of a list of 14 cities that figure in prominently in the account of Joshua's conquest, either east of the Jordan or west, and including even the cities of Arad and Hormah that were attacked under Moses' leadership, we have a list of 14 cities prominently mentioned. We score 3 definite hits. We can confirm at least the existence of 3 of the 14 cities. All the other cities were either unoccupied at the time, or in the case of Jericho, continued to be occupied with no disruption, or in the case of Yarmuth, Libna, and Eglon, the record is not yet clear. So even if we could clear up Yarmuth, Libna, and Eglon and confirm it, we would end up with a score of 6 out of 14. Not very encouraging evidence for the conquest. Now you can understand why the scholars began to look at that 1 Kings 6:1 more critically and say, well, maybe we've got the conquest in the wrong period. That's why we can't get many matches. Maybe we've been looking in the wrong time horizon. Maybe we need to shift our focus and study a different time setting for the conquest, and then maybe we'd score more hits. And that's why they began to think about, well, how could that 480 years be understood in another way? And that's when they landed on the idea, well, let's look at it. 480, you could arrive at 480 if you took 12 and multiplied it by 40. Now, why should they have did that back then? Why should they have used those years? Well, the generation that came out of Egypt died in the wilderness. And they were in the wilderness 40 years. So that might have given the Israelites the idea that a generation should be counted as 40 years. But why 12? Well, we have the 12 generations of the priests that are listed from Moses until Solomon. Maybe that's where they got the 12 from. Okay, so if we correct the 40 down to 25, which is more realistic, and keep the 12 generations, we only have 300 years. Ah, then instead of looking in 1405, we need to be looking in 1225, around 1225 B.C. Oh, 1225 B.C. What period is that? Well, 1225 B.C. is towards the end of the Late Bronze Age, as you would suspect, since the Late Bronze Age lasts from 1550 to 1200. You know, you're only 25 years before the end of it. So you're in the Late Bronze 2B period, towards the end of the Late Bronze 2B. Do we find any evidence for the conquest in that period? Well, William Foxwell Albright conducted a dig at the site of a village called Beitin. The village of Beitin was believed to be a toponym. Remember what toponyms mean? For the biblical city of Bethel. And as he was digging, he got down into the Late Bronze 2B period, the very period that they were beginning to suspect might be the period for the conquest. And he said he found a level of destruction at that site that that was without precedent. It was a terrible conflagration. The entire town had been horribly burned by a huge fire. Obviously, not just a fire that broke out in one quarter of the city. This was something that destroyed the whole town. The ash layer was tremendously thick. And equally impressive was the city that was destroyed was a very sophisticated culture. The culture in that city was a very sophisticated one. And right on top of the debris was the remains of another culture, very inferior in quality. The numbers of people that lived on the spot after the destruction were very few compared to those that had lived there before, and the evidence of their material culture was very crude. Albright wrote, "I am convicted on the basis of the fact that nowhere else in Canaan where I have excavated have I found such a tremendous destruction and the immediate replacement of a sophisticated culture by this very crude culture immediately after it. I am convinced by this, I have found the evidence of Joshua's invasion. That the people that resettled the site were Israelites, that their culture would obviously be cruder than that of the urbanized Canaanites, and since they were coming out of a situation where they've been wandering for 40 years, they would not have had a very sophisticated culture. I have found the evidence for Joshua's conquest, and indeed it is in the late Bronze 2B. It is this period that is the true period for the conquest." Sounds very good. But what's interesting when you begin to think of it in terms of biblical narrative? Where was he digging? What he thought was Bethel. And here this destruction is clearly the work of Joshua. What's the problem with relating that to the text? Brent?
Doesn't speak of him destroying the city of Bethel.
Yeah. There is absolutely no mention of Joshua attacking, let alone destroying, Bethel. And yet, it's not like he ignored Bethel. The text does not ignore Bethel. It specifically brings it in twice. When it talks about them killing the king of Ai, they throw in the parenthetical comment, which is located beside Bethel. And then the king of Bethel himself is mentioned as being killed in the text a little later in chapter 12, in verse 12. So it's not like Bethel is overlooked. Well, maybe the text didn't mention every spot the Israelites conquered. That's why it doesn't mention Bethel. You can't use that argument, because the text does make reference to Bethel. So the fact that it doesn't describe the destruction, even briefly, is a significant omission, if indeed they did destroy it. This is a peculiar way of restoring history if you find something that's missing. Then there is another major problem with the text itself. And that is the case of Hazor. What does it say about Hazor? Let's go back to where I left off reading. Chapter 11, verse 11. "They struck all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was none left breathing. Then he burned Hazor with fire." Well, look into the late Bronze 2B, the period of around 1225 BC. Was the city of Hazor destroyed then? Yes, it was. That was the conclusion by Yigael Yadin when he excavated the city. But notice, verse 12, "So all the cities of those kings that had allied with the king of Hazor, and all their kings Joshua took and struck with the edge of the sword." In other words, after they won the battle at the waters of Merom, remember there was a coalition of kings that gathered there under the leadership of the king of Hazor that gathered at Merom. After that defeat, they destroyed the armies utterly. There was nothing left to protect any of those cities in the north. It was easy then to conquer the cities. But notice what it says in the text explicitly. all of the cities of those kings and all the kings Joshua took and struck with the edge of the sword. Yes, they did conquer all of those cities. He utterly destroyed them as Moses, the servant of the Eternal, had commanded. But then the critical verse, verse 13. As for the cities that stood on their mounds, Israel burned none of them except Hazor only, which Joshua burned. A very explicit statement. They conquered all the cities in the north, but they only burned one, and that one was Hazor. When we look in the archaeological record for the late Bronze 2B period, the period of around 1225 BC, we find almost all of these Canaanite cities in the north were destroyed. But all of them were also burned. Now, isn't that odd that the scripture contains the explicit negative that while the cities were conquered, none of them were burned except Hazor? And yet, if the archaeologists are correct and they want to put the conquest in this period, they are happy, they applaud, oh, the cities were destroyed, just like it says in the Bible. Oops, a problem. They were also all burned. And the Bible says that none of them were burned except Hazor. How did that get into the text? Again, we don't have a match. Now, we'll pick up on this next time and see that this is just the big tip of the iceberg of the problems with the late date for the conquest. Already, it's not fitting too well. At first, they thought, oh, we found the evidence. It's great. But now they see the evidence doesn't fit quite that well. And then over the years since, it's been fitting less well, and less well. And so even now, this theory has been thrown overboard and has been replaced by a number of new theories, which we will begin to at least lightly touch upon next time.